From an undisclosed location in the Nevada desert, this is Jennifer Morency of WTF Radio. Welcome to Open Mic Night at the Cormorant Cafe, with your Master of Ceremonies and Master of Debates, Rob. My teddy bears were stolen by a...
Jesus Christ. Ah, what fucking day is it? I've been drinking. Is it Wednesday already? What are you people doing here? Okay, fine. I'm faking you out. I know what day it is. Alright, mic check is, I'm getting record level error messages. Alright, fine. So we're checking the mic. Alright, I'll be back in a minute. You guys should know I had a really productive week last week, so I'm going to take the rest of the year off. Maybe not. I'll probably finish this book though. Alright. I wonder if she has any of those peanut butter and jelly quarters. Alright, well, I'm gonna do Jennifer Morency's intro, but here's my dumb intro. I'm still Robert, or R. Wesley Edwards, if you're on Amazon looking for me. And this is still the Cormorant Cafe, which exists as long as you're here in my mind. And, she actually sent one of her audio clips. It's called A Spoonful of Sugar, I think. I'm going to listen to it when you listen to it for once, so we'll see what I can say about it. And oh, Heavenly Father, who looketh upon us with irreverence and pisses on us. And if anything, if listens to any prayers, it's only the prayers of the insane. But anyway, holy cow, I did a bunch of writing this past week. So we actually have a chapter 7. And in addition to writing, which I do with a pen, a beautiful pen, Actually, the shitty pen I have now is not the beautiful pen. But one day I will have a beautiful pen and I will write with it. I have a beautiful notebook though. I have two of them. They have leather covers. They're really pretty. And they smell good too. Anyway, so I wrote chapter 7. And then I revised and edited chapter 7 as I transcribed it into a Google Doc. And then earlier, and by earlier I mean Monday, so a couple days ago, I edited, so I took care of a second revision, which puts the chapter 7 in the same class of writing with the other 6 chapters that I've unloaded on you. And I really hope you liked it, because if you didn't, then I've basically been ruining my podcast. Which, I mean, it only exists to convince me to write more, so I guess I wrote chapter 7, so mission accomplished. But anyway, and it's really long. It's like 15 pages. It's 6,000 something words. I don't know if you know what that means, but I may have to read it in 2 separate podcasts. It's very long. It took me 3 hours, maybe 3.5 hours to edit this. Monday afternoon. All right. Anyway, here's Jennifer.
From an undisclosed location in the Nevada desert, this is Jennifer Morenci of WTF Radio. Welcome to Open Mic Night at the Cormorant Cafe with your master of ceremonies and master of debates, Rob. My teddy bears were stolen by a...
All right, I'm back. Hope you enjoyed that weird interlude that I made a few years ago with some weird music app on my phone. Yeah, if you guys had a forum, I could just hear you bitching about it. Oh, but there's like no audience. So I guess I can't really disappoint anyone. Okay, so let me see. I'm gonna read chapter 7. I know I promised you guys that we were done with this nonsense last week, but that was before I wrote chapter 7. That means that I'm right now figuring out what the fucking title is. There are just so many possibilities. Let's see, so chapter 7 is called The Devil's Spawn, and it's devil plural apostrophe. So, and the super title is An Imp's Tale. And it is ridiculously long, and I think there's 4 parts. Alright, so I'm going to read part 1 in a few seconds, and then I'll stop and play the Jennifer Morency's WTF news brief / comedy skit thing. I don't know what we call them. I find them funny, though, and you guys should pay her. Pay her with your lifeblood. And by that I mean cash. Not kidding. She's desperate. Do you really think she would be submitting these comedy things to me if she wasn't desperate? Alright, where was I? Okay, so chapter 7, The Devil's Spawn. Super title is An Imp's Tale. I'm gonna read part 1 of 4, and this one's called A Fall-Up. And my phone is broken. I'm looking for the... Oh, here we... Ah! Son of a monkey's ass. This is supposed to just be the introduction where I say, I'm going to read chapter 7, and now I have to jump around. Okay, well, that was weird and annoying. Alright, so chapter 7, part 1 is a false stop. This is one of the narrator's little asides, which this chapter, she just goes full on first person, but this is one of her little asides. Note, events described are true per attached resources. Some liberties, though, have been taken concerning the small alien's thoughts. My agent, and by the way, she always capitalizes agent in this context. Oh, stupid phone. Ah. I swear to God, it's trying to protect the screen. It's too late. The screen is burned and fried. All right. Okay, so part one, a false stop. Note, events described are true per attached resources. Some liberties, though, have been taken concerning the small alien's thoughts. My agent, capital A, attempted to use the demon, but unfortunately this resulted in the imp's immediate death and a permanent and irreparable malfunction in the device. Every time. The devil's spawn shook its head with confusion and frustration. This was an Eret sans pelote. It had read about them, but until this moment, never believed they were real. At least the air here was breathable and the temp tolerable. It looked around. Pure desolation. Perhaps desolation is too strong a word. The place was not a void or a battle aftermath. This is more untamed. It gave the matter another moment's thought. Maybe this place, this planet, has no development, neither fostering its own intelligent beings, nor colonized by others. The imp rubbed his crab-like hands together greedily. It was an innocent, virgin world, and as far as this devil was concerned, it was all his. The imp set off in the direction of some distant trees, east mainly, but a little north, presumably expecting fresh water. On the way, he got hungry, it seems, and pulled an entire scrub brush up out of the ground. As dirt rained down from... I just want it to warn me. It can't go dim. It just goes completely blank, and I have to unlock the... It's fine. I'm happy. Totally happy. Okay, the imp set off in the direction of some distant trees, east mainly, but a little north, presumably expecting fresh water. On the way, he got hungry, it seems, and pulled an entire scrub brush up out of the ground. As dirt rained down from freshly exposed roots, Frankie, my agent refers to the imp as Frankie in his reports, saw a pair of lizards, some insects, spiders, and worms. He threw the plant aside and snatched both lizards immediately, one in each claw-like hand. My agent watched in abject horror as the alien flung the small creatures into its vile maw and ate them alive. He, this devil's spawn, repeated this grotesque procedure over two more similarly discarded scrub bushes. Thus satisfied, the evil little monster. The journey took hours, during which my agent observed the imp and drew several pictures. My agent did not attempt to photograph him or obtain any biological samples, owing to, mainly, unfamiliarity with the species of imp. The alien was wearing a kind of low-top boots of a dark blue leather-like material, tied, or so it seemed, with yellow and brown fringe-like leather laces. Otherwise, its attire was askew and asymmetrical, rather brief, and consisted of only four belt-like brown leather straps. One around its midsection, like a proper belt, one around its large pale blue head as a headband, one for each arm, one was like a wristband or bracelet, the other a band slightly above the main joint my agent and I both hesitate to call an elbow. It appeared, according to my agent, and I'd confirm in time, as a smallish, pale blue human with huge eyes in its huge head, narrow, upward slits were probably nostrils, and a monstrous suckerfish-like maw lined with a circle of teeth. Finally, it left very deep footprints indicating it was probably quite heavy. My agent carefully followed this nasty little creature to a stream lined with tule, willow, and scrub, where it, the little alien, immediately set to work digging and cutting trees. He worked straight through for many, many months. One day, my agent observed the disgusting creature vacate its elaborate, though well-hidden, structure and go rapidly up the stream, leaving its deep, conspicuously alien footprints in the mud along the banks. Follow or investigate the imp's constructions? My agent stayed and went inside the elaborate building. Excuse me. Hold on. Okay, sorry. Once inside, there was no hint one was inside anything. This could have, by appearances, been inside a completely natural structure. My agent was, for the moment, at pains. So he reported, my agent was, for the moment, at pains, so he reported to divine what was done with the past several months' ingenuity and labor. While measuring the inside dimensions and about to leave, and regretting not following the beastie upstream, he noticed a loop of tightly woven hemp cord and realized it was attached to a wood and thatch trapdoor. My agent immediately exited the structure carefully and looked upstream. Nothing. He returned and, again, carefully, lifted the thatched door. Below him was a manhole which appeared to be composed of cement and a ladder, rungs of a polished blue material, some kind of metal, embedded in the cement. My agent threw himself down and pulled the thatched cover after. My agent reached the bottom after he stopped counting at two gross of these metal rungs. At 2.5 spans apart, he estimated the depth of at least 100 meters. At the bottom, he found himself in the middle of a narrow hall with a floor composed of plant matter inclined nearly a dozen degrees. He headed downhill first. The hall shortly opened up to a large room expertly cut from the ground, which was furnished with crude, compared to the metal ladder rungs, shelves, an oblong pile of plant material, and large cut stones which put in mind lounging benches and a table. This bedroom had a metal pipe coming out of the ceiling, and my agent was able to confirm it went up through all that ground to the outside for ventilation and possibly water, too. My agent then returned to the hall and made his way uphill past the ladder, but this time the hall turned 90 degrees and again, zigzagging left, then right, then left again. It ended at a low arched doorway framed with river stones. The attached door was crafted of expertly carved willow wood with etched and tinted glass embedded at what would be the alien's eye level. The imp continued to surprise. Clearly a skilled individual. My agent peeked past the open door, but the room beyond was absolutely pitch black in darkness. He realized this was different and sought to determine from whence the illumination of the other room and the hall. There's dot, dot, dot. My agent then removed a torch from his satchel, which means flashlight. The thing uses British spellings for things, too. So if you were reading the book, you would have seen the British spelling for endeavor in the first chapter, for example. Or if he says color, he spells it the British way. Well, not he. The narrator's a female. But never mind. You'll see. Anyway, so he doesn't know. He just realized that the hall must have been illuminated, but he didn't think about it until he was encountered this completely dark room. My agent then removed a torch, which is a flashlight, from his satchel, activated it, and threw its light into the darkened chamber. He almost fell down, he told me later, and turned back to the hall at this accursed place immediately. What he saw was either a veterinary doctor's surgery or a torture chamber. Along one wall was a bank of a dozen cages and more of the skillfully cut stone furniture. Opposite the cages were machines whose use was impossible for my agent to guess, being that he's not a sadistic lizard-crunching alien, but there were harnesses and straps as for heads and wrists or necks, sharp implements and benches lined with what appeared to be leather and more plant material at all number of angles. As he retraced his way quickly now, less stealthy, still downhill, in the bent zigzaggy hall, he saw a door that he hadn't noticed before. It was clearly meant to be hidden. Even though he felt he'd been in the little devil's lair quite long enough, if not too long already, my agent opened this door and found inside an armory. Stands along two walls contained innumerable halberds, these long poles with shiny, almost ornamental hatchets on the ends, topped with remarkably sharp, spear-like blades. The other walls contained inlaid displays fronted with a glass-like substance and lit from within. Dirks, dozens and dozens of them, with their small, curved, vicious knife blades of the same blue metal as the ladder rungs. My agent then returned to the hall. He took the metal ladder back to the surface. He returned to his bird hide and endeavored to contact me while producing a full and detailed report. I moved at once to join him. I brought all the surveillance equipment I could comfortably carry and a few battery force generators and, of course, my crossbow. It was still dozens of years before Merlin would crash land here in this valley, but the imp was here the same way we were, more or less. The bubble event expanded backward and forward a billion years in each direction. Technically, we were compiling supplemental biographical information on Grandpa and my father, and if I am especially lucky, though I may need more than the usual help from my agent to get it, my uncle. But this was so breathtakingly strange, I felt it was worth the diversion. And that is the end of part one of chapter 7. And that was 12 minutes. Okay, that ridiculously long. That was... Wow. Alright, so part one already is 12 minutes. Let's check in with Jennifer for her WTF something, spoonful of sugar. Get ready for the announcement tone.
Welcome to another episode of WTF, the show that's trying to save journalism by mixing it with humor. As Dr. Biden says, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Oh wait, that was Dr. Mary Poppins. When I worked in a newsroom, all the other reporters, including the interns and part-timers, had those really expensive $2,000 MacBooks. I had my trusty $500 Windows laptop, often running Linux just for laughs. I always kind of styled myself as the low-budget news babe, cheap, but well-built and reliable. You know how people talk about how great their iPhones are? But I can do something with an Android that nobody can do with an iPhone, namely buying one for $15. Though it has a built-in virus that I'm still trying to get rid of, it only cost me $15. I gotta tell you, that virus keeps popping up like something out of The Exorcist. I'm trying every free Android anti-malware app that I can find, since the first one just scanned the virus, said okay, and let it install. Maybe an iPhone is better. But I'd like to see an iPhone that costs $15. Sometimes I see people online complaining about paywalls. Well, I'm very poor and also a huge nerd, so I don't know what is this paywall they speak of. My hobby is getting into places where I'm not supposed to be. That's a skill that came in handy when I worked as a crime reporter. It also comes in handy on the internet. So how about rent? That's got to be the biggest scam in human existence. Basically, you're paying the interest on the second mortgage that the property management company has taken out on the building. The bank that really owns the building uses that interest to pay a dividend on a collateralized loan obligation, which is a financial contrivance worse than a junk bond. The equity tranches of the CLO are held by some horrible hedge fund, like maybe Mitt Romney's Bain Capital, or even worse, maybe the Skybridge Fund, which is run by no other than Anthony Scaramucci, the Mooch. And his fund is worth $7 billion. I wonder how much cheaper rent would be if we just cut out all the middlemen and pay it directly to the Mooch himself. It would probably cost half as much. As Chairman Mao might have said, fuck rent. As the quote misattributed to George Orwell says, journalism is saying what someone else does not want said. Everything else is public relations. Thank you all for being such a great audience this week. If you enjoy my work, please remember that my donation link is v.gd/jenmor. My Twitter is at Jennifer Morency with an I.
Hey, I'm back from whatever it is I do when I'm not talking. Alright, I was going to make a joke, but I couldn't think of anything that wasn't obvious. Alright, so let me see. Dr. Mary Poppins. iPhones don't cost $15. Virus from The Exorcist. No, she pretty much said it all. I didn't know we could get them that cheap in the U.S. She said something about refurbished. I have a back channel to Morency. So, you know that we're friends. I just don't know which desert she's in. alright, so, where were we? Okay, so I'm going to read a thing. I'm going to read part 2 from chapter 7. So let's see if we can recap. All right, so this is kind of like that campfire. So far, it's kind of like that campfire story chapter where you don't necessarily need the rest of... In fact, it's almost like that time anomaly chapter where the rest of the book is kind of irrelevant. It's just like a freak of the week. Our main dude makes his little guest appearance at the end or whatever. And in this case, it's going to be like that as well, kind of. But so we're going to read part 2. Let's real quick. Part 1. Some creature appears from, I'll just say it to you, somewhere in the galaxy. But he appears in West Covina. I'm sorry, in the Archangel Valley, where our stories are taking place. The narrator's agent, which she always capitalized the A, follows the dude around. He's dressed in, like, leather straps and apparently Timberland boots. They're blue. And, and then he eats lizards, and that causes the narrator and the agent to be... kind of, well, you'll see, they become very insulting, like, very quickly, like, monster and bastard and motherfucker. Anyway, and then they think he's building some kind of, like, hidden fort, but he's building some kind of underground lair. He takes a walk one day, and the agent, you know, whether he follows him or whether he inspects the structure that he's been building. So the agent goes into the structure, doesn't see shit, is about to leave, and realizes that there's like a trapdoor. He checks the imp, the creature's not coming back. So he hops down the little manhole where the trapdoor covers, and it's down, whatever. He estimates it's 100 meters or so, whatever he estimates. The ladder rungs that he takes down are made of some kind of a metallic, some kind of blue metal. And the ground he finds himself on is covered with, like, you know, leaves and tree branches and stuff. And it's at he calls it a 12-degree angle. He goes, I think, downhill first, and he finds what he thinks is like a imp's little, like, bedroom or whatever. He goes the other way, but the hallway kind of zigzags, and he finds what he assumes is some kind of torture chamber. He also figures out that this torture chamber is somehow, like, it's dark, but, like, the hallway wasn't dark, and the other room wasn't dark, so somehow there's some kind of artificial lighting. Right as he's about to leave, because now he thinks he's been there too long, and he pretty much thinks he's seen everything, he sees another door, and so he opens it, and he finds an armory, and inside is, like, rows and rows of this thing called a halberd. It's a, like, imagine a spear, but on the end is like a, is like an axe head. And, but it's there, some of them are very ornamental. And so the spear goes through to the end. So it's still a sharp edge, but there's also a hatchet kind of thing. So you can stab with it. You can also kind of hatch it down with it, but it's got a long handle. And this imp alien creature has tons of these, rows and rows of them. And then he also has these, like, little lighted display cases with some kind of glass-like substance. And inside them are these curved little knives, these that the narrator, the agent, calls dirks. And they are made of the same blue metal as the ladder rungs. And after that, I think he goes back up the rungs of the ladder, and he sends off to the narrator, and basically the report is, holy crap, there's an underground lair. And then she gets dressed to join. She wears whatever, her armor, and she brings surveillance equipment. Alright, so now I guess I'm going to read part 2 of chapter 7, and part 2 is titled, A Native Child is Mistreated. Alright, so, part 2, A Native Child is Mistreated. Alright, probably we should have intervened and risked a visit from Corey and Flynn. The imp returned shortly after I joined my agent in the bird hide. We were far, easily 36 kilometers southeast of Merlin's eventual crash site, but comfortably within the Conti / bubble. The imp was attired about the same as when it first appeared, except he carried a dirk in one hand and had a scabbard for it attached to his midsection belt. The devil spawn was licking and biting the blade when we caught sight of him. He returned it to his scabbard and walked rapidly in rapidly. He returned it to its scabbard and walked rapidly into his hidden. My agent and I were hooking up tubes and wires and fuel into generators. So she indicates with italics that if he leaves, I said with silent gestures in my eyes. Yes, my agent nodded. If he leaves again, put these devices into his rooms. I held up the transceiver bulbs and placed them into his satchel. After dark that night, naturally, my agent and I had earlier established a local comlink. While he pulled usual lookout duty in the bird hide with some new equipment, I made myself invisible and walked in an outward spiral, crossbow at the ready. I was itching to shoot something. I'll admit I was highly disturbed by this alien imp, and it really activated my primal reptilian brain, that sick lizard-eating motherfucker. With that thought, I aimed the weapon downward, and see, the damn screen shuts off. With that thought, I aimed the weapon downward for the remainder of my patrol and concentrated on the oafish, though hilarious, antics of my father, my uncle, and their soldier friend. But still, now, she's going to say, and she repeats it repeatedly, she says it repeatedly, that sick lizard-eating motherfucker, but she says it in Esperanto, and so you're going to have to just excuse me in my horrible translation, but my understanding is it would sound a lot like Spanish. So she says, but still, tiu masana la cert manga mingya petrafinculo exclamation mark. All right. Hopefully I didn't mess up the microphone there. Sorry. She says, I patrolled all night and, suspecting it'd be necessary, established another bird hide. Jesus Christ, okay. The phone shut off again. Why? I don't understand why it doesn't just lower the light instead of going completely locked. I really need to look at my settings. I absolutely hate that. She says, I patrolled all night and, suspecting it'd be necessary, established another bird hide on the other side of the stream. I returned with the sunrise. My agent had begun making a stimulant-infused hot beverage, but, in a tribute to irony perhaps, fell asleep in the process, opened crystal sweetener packet almost falling from his fingers. I poured myself one of his strong, almost unpalatable mate concoctions and sipped it as I sat opposite him, watching his slumber while brainstorming how to unlock my uncle's so-called origin story. Oh, no, she didn't say so-called. She, quote-unquote, origin story. My agent's lips moved, perhaps something in his dream, and I suddenly realized something so damn obvious I'm embarrassed to admit it now. Icon's, quote-unquote, green man tutor is also my agent. I said, holy shit, out loud, and in American English, and my agent woke, said, what? What happened? Butch, I said, I think I need you to violate the space-time continuum. And he nodded, because that's the kind of agent my agent is. After a dozen days and innumerable patrols with no more obvious activity, interesting or otherwise, from that lizard-eating motherfucker, I returned to other work, leaving my agent to his, I thought at the time, oh, to this, okay. I returned to other work, leaving my agent to this, I thought at the time, side mission. Now she's going to call him the lizard-eating motherfucker again. The Malsana Lassert Mangima Patronficulo went on several more excursions, and my agent was able to bug all his rooms, including the above-ground entrance area inside the hidden structure, which she originally called an alcove. Many months passed, and Frankie, which was now becoming our nickname for the imp, did these excursions upstream, made additional dirks and halberds to adorn his armory, slept, and little else. It was mid-morning, and my agent was enjoying tea and a scone, or whatever British garbage he feeds himself, when he became aware of some rustling in the trees. The birds were disturbed. The alien never disturbed the birds. Disturbed the birds? The alien never disturbed the birds. My agent, though, could see nothing unusual. Then a whoosh and a thwunk of a hollow arrow embedding itself into the facade of the bird hide itself. She puts an exclamation mark. My agent slowly, carefully ducked down. The imp came out into the open and went straight up to the bird hide. It was within arm's reach of my agent and one of her little italicized notes, who would have saved us a shitload of trouble had he ignored anthropological ethics and murdered that... it's so frustrating, phone, why? The imp came out into the open and went straight up to the bird hide. It was within arm's reach of my agent, and then she says, who would have saved us a shitload of trouble had he ignored anthropological ethics and murdered that bastard then and there. Frankie touched the arrow shaft, then the bird hide itself. How he didn't hear my agent's breathing or smell him, or through some other sense become aware of him, is a mystery. Then, using both claws, he plucked the arrow from the outside wall of the bird hide. As the imp examined the arrow and ran the edge of one of his open claws against the arrowhead, my agent, and the imp himself, heard the distant snap of a bow releasing a second arrow. Hold on. Yes. Yes, I sneeze sometimes too. Why? Why am I sneezing? I have the virus. Which is why. Alright. Alright. As the imp examined the arrow and ran the edge of one of his open claws against the arrowhead, my agent and the imp himself heard the distant snap of a bow releasing a second arrow. Whoosh! This one embedded itself into the alien's upper back without discernible noise. Frankie did not react. Two beats. The imp turned slowly as my agent became aware of a slightly dark teenage human girl mounted atop a large horse. Hopping down from the animal's back, she knocked a third arrow and advanced rapidly toward the imp. Before she could shoot, the motherfucker grabbed her and they disappeared into his hidden structure. And she's got one of her little notes. My agent quickly retrieved her third arrow and bow and concealed them with himself in the number 2 surveillance station. And then, the next paragraph, sorry. My agent collected all the out-of-time anachronisms, our surveillance equipment and power generators and other tech, and as carefully as possible, relocated across the stream to the aforementioned replacement surveillance station. And she put in parentheses, bird hide. And once established, my agent zipped me a report with the understated title, quote, "There has been a development," end quote. For my agent and his gift of understatement and brevity, it had been months and months. For me, it had been mere moments ago that I'd left him in the bird hide watching the alien with instructions to bug his rooms. I needed a nap, at least, and a bath, before I acted upon this intelligence. I had gremlins and goblins to feed and a book or two to consult. I took an epic shower and collapsed in my mudroom for at least 3 days, before I finally awoke and spent some quality time outside with my own banks of cages, then spent the rest of that beautiful afternoon, after waking, reading in the nook in my library. Now, normally, I would have flown immediately upon receiving word that a human had been taken prisoner by the accidentally teleported alien imp creature, especially one that blithely eats my ancestors like popcorn. But I really was tired and dirty, and I needed to learn a thing or two, if possible, about these West Covina Indians. The Spanish called them Gabrielino, after the Archangel Valley and the mountains and river and their mission there. And for political reasons, the false name of Tongva was given them by the Americans, but they were also called Quiche, a word derived from their word for their huts with thatched roofs made of willow and tul trees and brush. The nearest village to our bird hide, and thus the young woman's likely home, was called Nordo de los Dono de Productantos. Sorry about my pronunciation. Roughly translated, north of Maker's Stone. Quiche villages contained several dozen of these huts, which amounted to at least 100 people, but maybe as many as 300, or even more. After feeding my gremlins and goblins again and turning my phone back on, and clothing myself in some heavier armor, I used her use of Esperanto all the time. I used Sablo Hor Logo. It's hard to pronounce. It should be easy because it's like Spanish. Sablo Hor Logo de Avo and my own parallel vortex generator to return to the 1700s where the drama was unfolding. I immediately made myself invisible and advanced to the original bird hide. An arrow, as described, was on the ground nearby, and standing there, I found it difficult to believe my agent was not discovered by either the human girl or the imp. I also found another arrow. She perhaps dropped it when the imp assailed her, and some white sticky goo, which I took to be imp blood, of which I collected a very small sample. I also took molecular... Jesus, fuck phone. She says she took it to be imp blood, of which I collected a very small sample. I also took molecular resolution images of both arrows. I didn't know my agent had one stashed with her bow. After taking some time to dismantle the original bird hide completely and absolutely, but leaving both arrows in situ, I rejoined my agent across the stream in the new station / bird hide. Of course, it was probable, if not inevitable, that the imp and the local population of humans would cross paths and interact, but to be honest, we expected more time. This was all uncharted, This was all uncharted territory as Max Wreckage was rewriting the very reality around us. I finally rejoined my agent, who barely acknowledged my presence, such was the drama on his viewers. We heard the girl's horse getting impatient, and, as there was no chance the foreigner would soon release the native, I, ethics be damned, made myself invisible and bolted. I found the horse at a nearby willow tree, which was part of the imp's structure. I leaped upon its back and rode the little way toward the nearest village, where I left it to find its own way. I hurried back to Butch, hoping my actions were unnoticed by the imp and the meddling imbeciles associated with Officer Evans. While I was thus employed, I hope, saving the animal's life, my agent was watching the devil spawn lock the young woman. My agent was watching the devil spawn lock the young human woman into one of his contrivances and begin to torture her. She says, I returned to surveillance station number two again. I had already... What's going on with these things? Is this microphone broken? I hope it's not messing up, because this is really long. I returned to surveillance station number two again. And then she says, I had already violated the hell out of all standard anthropology and ethnographic ethical guidelines. And I also had clear-cut violations, plural, of the timeline. But if Butch and I went in and retrieved the human and gave that sick lizard-eating motherfucker what he had coming, besides interfering with our other besides interfering with our other biographical data collection work and becoming vulnerable to detection by the likes of Evans and his meddling idiots, besides risking our own capture at the hands claws of the imp, you no doubt see the problems. Besides all the above listed potential complications, if we went in guns blazing, as humans are sometimes known to say, the human teenager would certainly see us, and we certainly don't want to kill her. If we wait, assuming she isn't killed, and Frankie returns to the surface and my agent tracks him, perhaps, if I'm invisible, I can release the human girl in a way she, I hope, will think her own doing. If she thinks she escaped on her own, maybe I won't have to compound our problems by murdering, continuing tracking police officers. All of the above wild and terrible thoughts were consuming me alive and burning me up from the inside as I rejoined my agent in the backup bird hide, where we rehashed the above and weighed our options and made plans for possible actions. We agreed we were in a bind, and the ethical imperative, do nothing, and the moral choice, rescue the woman, kill the imp, there's little chance we could get her safely out with the devil spawn not detecting our activity, if he hadn't already. We're 180 degrees opposed. I instructed my agent, though was hardly necessary, to be vigilant at all times and to send a brief emergency communique should the imp leave the girl alone, and I, frustrated, sad, mentally fatigued, and feeling nearly defeated, returned to my little cabin on my San Bernardino hilltop to tend my charges and work on these biographies. I longed for the straightforward situation in which I found my father with his demon, which made the whole thing a dull grind. The transcription took 3 days, of course. But there was little danger I'd be forced to kill anyone or leave an innocent woman or horse to die. And she has one of her little asides at this as the end of part two, and I'll read her little note. If you're wondering why my agent or myself don't simply interview Merlin for this biographical work, I'll tell you now, it is simple enough. he isn't on Earth. And if we found him before he leaves and interacted with him, we'd be violating the timeline. And that is the end of part two. Let's see. Wow, part two is 17 minutes long. Holy shit. That thing is going to be really long. I think I can do the whole chapter, though. But, I got this nifty classic lesbian love poetry. I'm sorry, classic lesbian love poems book. So what I'm going to do is open it at random. See, page 33. Alright, let's see. Go back to the beginning of whatever this is. Alright, here we go. It's very short. So I'm going to read this. It says Sappho at the top. At the bottom it says translated by Mary Bernard. It's like a little palate cleanser. Since I don't have any volunteers, since you guys don't read. Alright. Here we go. Palate cleanser and preview for our special The Key to Everything Lesbian Love Poetry episode, which is, we're building it. Don't worry, we're making it. And when I say we, I mean Marinci and I. Alright, Sappho, I suppose, is the writer and translated by Mary Bernard. I don't know why these things don't have titles. I have had not one word from her. Frankly, I wish I were dead. When she left, she wept. A great deal, she said to me. Quote, this parting must be endured, Sappho. I go unwillingly, end quote. I said, quote, go and be happy. But remember, you know well whom you leave shackled by love. If you forget me, think of our gifts to Aphrodite and all the loveliness that we shared. All the violet tiaras, braided rosebuds, dill and crocus twined around your young neck, myrrh poured on your head and on soft mats, girls with all that they most wished for beside them, while no voices chanted, choruses without ours, no woodlot bloomed in spring without song. End quote. And now, Macmillan the Magician, Chapter 7, Part 3. Merlin, Chapter 7, Part 3, Massacre. Of course, I expected to be greeted with a hypertime 911 within moments of my return, so I set to work collecting up the best extraction tools. Instead, I'm a little sad to report, that scenario did not happen. The imp kept the young woman for months and months. My agent in that time documented several search parties from the nearby Kish village. The devil spawn never came above ground in all that time. He spent his days studying and torturing the human woman, producing innumerable dirks and halberds, cutting a fourth room opposite his armory, and sleeping on his oblong pile of leaves and sticks. One day, the imp, that sick lizard-eating motherfucker, finally killed the young woman. He'd been in the process of making several long cuts to the inside of her left upper thigh and nicked an artery there, and she rapidly bled out. No sooner was she dead, but the imp decapitated her and began butchering her, cutting off her limbs, removing her organs, and eating some of them. The devil's spawn then began constructing a kind of suit from her skin and mounted her head on the end of one of his sticks that was too short for his halberds. Less than an hour, such was the alien's speed, after she drew her final breath, the imp emerged from his hidden structure, looking almost exactly like she did when my agent first saw her mounted upon her Spanish horse. My agent sent the following emergency hypergraph: return immediately. We cannot save the girl. Instantaneously, I emerged from my own vortex outside the bird hide, where I found my agent, himself moving rapidly with his satchel and a camper's rucksack strapped to his shoulders. He actually had the gall to carry conspicuously one of our guns, an impossible to conceal heavy rifle. To my disapproving expression, he walked past me. Holy shit, I said, trailing behind and striding quickly to keep up. I made myself invisible, though at the time I thought it scarcely mattered, and kept myself several meters behind Butch, who clearly knew where he was going. Months before, he'd employed an eye to follow, as a dragonfly perhaps, one of the search parties when they passed the surveillance station number 2, and tracked it back to the village where I'd correctly sent the horse. He was able to glean some anthropological data from this almost on a par with my light library readings. But again, we were too late, and ahead of us, we could see great volumes of smoke and then ravaging flames threatening to engulf the entire area in a wildfire in the vanishing light of sunset. We were tramping north for less than an hour, and we're really only about 20 minutes behind Frankie the Imp, disguised as a female Quiche teenage warrior. When we started seeing evidence of a fire, I leaped into the air with 2 more such jumps. I was at the village. All the tule and willow huts were ablaze. No one was running for cover or away or toward the flames in any kind of attempt to flee or help the others. This was a bad, bad sign. In a hut, I found the slain In a hut, I found the slain bodies of native couples, families, and individuals. There were other bodies outside the blazing huts with deep wounds to their abdomens and throats and inner thighs. Finally, and by now Butch was at hand, we saw the imp. Our instinct and perhaps adrenaline, Butch and I ducked aside and watched from shadows. The imp was standing in the center of the Quiche village, all huts around him ablaze, holding a halberd as my father would, in a century or so, hold a tisling staff. I placed a hand on my agent's shoulder and nudged the rifle. He lowered it. Stay out of sight, I suggested. The imp was proceeding from hut to hut and eventually left the village heading east. I made myself invisible. I followed that murderous asshole, and Butch and his giant gun went looking for survivors, but there were none. The imp found a corral where he took one of a dozen or so horses and he rode it as though not for the first time, whereupon he returned to his lair. I, seething, exhausted and covered in dust and ash, watched on a view screen as he put away the weapon and a dirk I hadn't noticed and went to sleep on his oblong willow branch bed. Butch rejoined a couple hours later and confirmed, no survivors. He'd opened the corral and untied the remaining horses. For some reason, Butch thought the fire was unintentional. That's the end of part 3. Oh, wow. Well, that one was mercifully short, considering the events. All right, I feel like now's a good time for another preview from the Key to Everything. These aren't actually a preview because I'm not going to reread them for that special bonus episode. I'm just going to... I'm just going to read them at random here. Some of these are remarkably short. In fact, all of them are really short, but this book is... Actually, the book is short, but it's not short like I could just read the whole thing through. Let's see if I can't find... Here we go. Here's something. We'll call this another palate cleanser because it's desperately needed. And another, hey, let's look forward to some poetry reading from The Key to Everything, Classic Lesbian Love Poems, edited by Jerry Gomez Perlberg. Speaking of Jerry Gomez Perlberg, this seems to be something that person, I'm guessing woman, since it would have to be, right, wrote it. Tide Pool Valentine by Jerry Gomez Perlberg. It's G-E-R-R-Y if you're looking. O you of slicked back mermaid hair and soapstone skin tattooed with fish sticks and fish bones. Your spiked stalactite hanging low in the salt caked cave of my desire, dangerously close to scraping bottom. The arthritic ache of these my hands, which long to touch your trickled pool, to touch you there, and press their fingers to your cheek and rub their knuckles in your briny stream of iridescent weeds as dark as knives, like blind cave fish blanched pink by lack of light. Submerge your lips and breasts and nipple clips, your barnacles in rocky silver slits. The hot gusto of your lips frenching mine like baby squid in soft curd cones. Submerge the keyhole limpet me, yes, bore your bright tangelo bones through my crab heart of soft shelled stone. And now back to our friend Macmillan. I hope you enjoyed the little interlude. Alright, it's time for the last part of Chapter 7 of Macmillan the Magician. I believe this part is called Merlin, again. The little part names get simpler and simpler. All right, we have come to the last part, part 4, Macmillan the Magician, chapter 7. It's not over there. All right, it's not in a book. Putting the book down. Here it is. Part 4, Merlin, again. Hey, this is one of her little notes. She says, rather than subject my agent to more psychic scarring while the imp slumbered, we dismantled surveillance station number 2 and left automated surveillance bugs and eyes, hoping it was enough. And this was all, or nearly all, for about 150 years. That ends her little note. Sometime in the middle of May, 1886, Merlin emerged from the wreckage of the Endeavor carrying a thick-handled, wand-like object and wearing a large black and yellow backpack. A thick black cable connected the one thing to the backpack. "Computer," he said. Two beeps. "Where is this metallic debris?" He put, apparently he'd been talking about it because the metallic debris is also in quotes. So the computer says, "Merlin, it is buried 36 kilometers south and east. Walking, you'll arrive in 6 hours at noon." Which meant Merlin was headed for the imp's lair where he'd detected somehow the metal of those dirks, halberds, ladder rungs, and torture devices. Now it's another one of her notes. According to notes made available to me much later, this was the third such excursion for Merlin. He'd recovered bits of debris from his own ship and other apparently relevant resources. End note. And so, at nearly noon, two beeps. "Merlin, you've nearly reached the buried metallic cache," end quote. Merlin unhooked the wand from the backpack and fiddled with it. He stopped abruptly, though, dropped the wand thing, which swung by its cable, and cradled his head in his hands as he fell to his knees upon the ground. "Computer," he cried, two beeps. "Shut it off, shut it off." "Yes, Captain." Merlin took off the large backpack. He then got up and sat on the backpack for a long moment. Finally, rubbing his temples. "Computer, does that mean I'm in the midst of the debris, or on top of it, or..." End quote. He showed signs of recovering, but slowly. "The signal is very strong indeed," the escape pod's computer confirmed. Merlin unclasped a small telescoping spade from the side of the backpack, and he began digging. After 2 hours and nearly digging 2.5 meters, Merlin, dirty as hell, climbed out of the hole and picked up the wand. "Computer, how deep is this stuff buried?" Two beeps. "Merlin?" "Insufficient data to answer." Merlin cut the machine off. Okay, I'll figure it out," end quote. He began unhooking dark rods of about a span and a half from around the backpack and thrusting them into the ground at 6-meter intervals. He lifted the backpack with apparent difficulty and strapped it back on. He walked several paces away. I'm sorry, I sometimes forget what I wrote. He walked several paces away and then fidgeted with the wand. "Computer, it's easily 100 meters below the surface," end quote. I've got a little indicator that some kind of time has passed, like a double-spaced paragraph. "At about this time, one of my agent's eyes became active as the imp rummaged in his armory and then began ascending his steel blue..." Ha ha. Alright, my fault. "At about this time, one of my agent's eyes..." Now, it's italicized in capital, the word "I," because it's a reference. It's an homage to a science fiction story where the Harrison uses eyes as a kind of flying surveillance machine. I'll tell you about it if you ask me. "At about this time, one of my agent's eyes became active as the imp rummaged in his armory and then began ascending his blue steel ladder rungs toward the surface. Large data packets were relayed to my agent, who was in San Diego in the mid-2000s at a comic convention." And she put a little aside, "where he wouldn't need a disguise, huh? And it's on Earth Double Prime. My agent determined that the lizard-eating, Kaj-massacring motherfucker was within moments of meeting my grandpa. And at about this time, but a cool 500 million, give or take, years in the future, though on this same instance of Earth, I and several of my charges were enjoying a warm bath when suddenly the mudroom was awash in blinking lights and piercing noises of a dozen or so alarms. To be honest, I nearly ruined the water, such was my surprise. I climbed out from amongst the jets and bubbles, the relaxing warm and hot water and the embrace of my thankfully less jumpy goblin charges, and found a hyper data node which I attached to the scales on my wrist. With a word, I deactivated the alarms. "All hell's breaking loose. What is it?" It's a quote. And then the agent says back, whatever. So her name is T-Y-Z-M-Y-N. And it doesn't come up that often because, well, she's the narrator. And so it doesn't, except in this chapter. So the agent speaking, sorry. Quote, "Tisman!" Exclamation. "Tisman!" "The lizard eater, he's, Merlin has walked right up to his lair. I think we may need to," he gets cut off. She says, "Oh, all right." And then, end quote. "I suppressed my excitement." Quote, "Understood." She says it, exclamation, "Understood." And then, end quote. "Perhaps I didn't suppress it well." Quote, "All right, you can stay where you are. Give Captain Kirk my best," end quote. I close contact before his reaction to realizing I knew where he was. I dressed as calmly as possible, though quickly too, given my anticipation of some excitement, and activated a newer vortex mechanism which depended less on Merlin's hourglass. She has one of her little notes. It says, I really need to return this thing, and to note. I then stepped into the shimmering metallic oval, felt the usual pins and needles, and the lungs burning sensation of being overinflated or simply turned inside out, and was at once in the imp's armory. I took a dirk from a stone table and a scabbard too, don't mind if I do, I said aloud, then exited to his hall, made myself invisible, and located his ladder. Looking up, I saw that sure enough, the imp was nearly at the surface above me. He carried, though awkwardly, one of his axe-stick halberds. Likely he had a dirk or two as well. I ascended rapidly behind him as quietly as possible. Another double-spaced paragraph is here. Back on the surface, and I could have killed an... Oh, no, I'm sorry, not back on the surface. It's still her talking. She says, on the surface, and I could have killed and gutted the little bastard then and there, but I didn't. The imp looked around. We were both inside his hidden structure, which was unchanged from about a century and a half ago. He abruptly froze, clearly seeing Merlin, and left the safety of his camouflaged area. I came out from under the thatched trapdoor, still invisible, though Merlin, of course, could see me if I was not careful to avoid being in his line of sight. I emerged from the hidden structure just as Merlin noticed the alien. Merlin turned invisible briefly. Then he appeared to be an imp. Finally, he was Merlin again. The physics and biochemistry underneath his and my and Tisman's chameleon effects interacts with my eyes and mental perceptions far, far differently than how it does with humans and those like my agent. Given that the imp had been aware of Merlin before Merlin knew it existed, the alien simply didn't believe Merlin was one of his kind. Not that I think it would have mattered, of course. Of course, the passive camouflage was as ineffective as when small children seem to think closing their eyes makes them invisible. It was too late, too, by the time Merlin realized he wasn't alone. The imp charged at Merlin with halberd up, and Merlin almost didn't act appropriately, and I wondered in this breathtaking moment what would happen to me if Merlin Prime were killed and eaten by this alien. Would he still survive, somehow? And if he did, how? And if he did not, wouldn't it present a paradox? But Merlin, sensing danger, finally ducked and turned and ran, throwing off his large backpack. He ran and he ran and he ran. The imp, too, ran. Of course, I knew Merlin was not running full speed. I, invisible, except to Merlin, took off after them with relative ease, hopping as a flea but keeping my distance. I didn't want to be noticed by the aliens, certainly couldn't risk being detected by Merlin himself. Merlin was heading back the way he'd come, toward the interceptor wreckage, and I assumed at the time Merlin intended to obtain and use a weapon he'd stashed on or near what was left of the ship. I tend to forget that my grandfather's a tricky old bastard. Whereas Tisman had always been very go with the flow, as you may say, Merlin tended to take situations in a more engaged manner. So that conjecture of mine that he was going to retrieve a weapon was proved false when Merlin just ran right past the wreckage and headed up and into the mountains to the north. Still wielding the halberd, the imp stayed hot on his heels, as it were. To coin a phrase, she says. Still wielding the halberd, the imp stayed hot on his heels, to coin a phrase. My agent, well, one of several future versions I'd later send to watch the wreckage, hailed me when we were about a dozen kilometers away. I rushed forward and slid into his bird hide. And then she's speaking. It says, Butch, I'm... And then he cuts her off. Yes, Teresa, you're from my past. He lit a cigarette. She puts an exclamation mark. And took a drag. And then he's talking again. I take it you're chasing Merlin and the squat alien monster from West Covina. End quote. He handed me the cigarette. In the future, I smoke? I intended to pretend to take a drag and hand it back, but made the mistake of inhaling instead. My eyes watered and I suppressed a cough. I handed the abomination back to my future agent. Yeah, all right, Teresa. Merlin has a tag. 1344/alpha, he said, handing me a small stone and glass tracker viewer. Since when does he call me Teresa? That's not my name. It's not even close. And then she says, thanks, those will kill you. I said, nodding at his cigarette-holding hand, and left him to head... And so she left him in order to head north and west up Mount Low and to the canyon beyond, where I was tracking Merlin using this glossy device. My lungs still burned from the single drag I'd accidentally taken from Butch's cancer stick. What the hell, future self? But his tracker viewer was a savior indeed. Still invisible, though throat and lungs and eyes burned, I found them. Merlin the imp in an apparent face-off. And they were dangerously, for me anyway, close to the edge, the bubble event edge. They were really far north and about as far west as it is possible to be and still be inside the bubble event. I knew this place, although half a billion years would be a little rough on it. This was where Tisman and the Badger will dispatch the orcs twice. And never mind, that's its own story. I saw the imp first, though how, through watery, tear-filled eyes, may be classed as a mystery. Due to his long weapon, which axe had glistened in the midday sun, the tracking device vibrated. I pocketed it and watched from a shadowy corner, crouched behind rocks in a kind of dry, hollow, tree-like plant. Finally, I caught sight of Merlin. He was apparently sneaking up on the imp, though he wasn't invisible. I caught myself rubbing the back of my neck and put my hand down, putting weight onto it, knuckles sinking into the soft, dry dirt. Merlin abruptly stood up. He shouted something like, "Over here, you pale-assed alien bitch!" To which the imp turned, raising his halberd weapon, and Merlin fired a beam of plasma at him. He, Grandpa, somehow... He fucking missed the galaxy's easiest ever shot, and the imp took off running west. And then she has a little note. West is bad, Frankie. Very bad. Merlin gave chase. The imp dropped the halberd and crouch jumped like a kind of frog from rock to rock upon the cliffs and crests of the mountains. I certainly could not follow them if they kept this up. One of my bracelets was almost painfully vibrating warnings already. I wasn't sure entirely what would happen if I attempted to leave Merlin's disaster site, exclusion zone, bubble event, edge. I simply stopped, and I waited. I had a kind of spyglass. It wasn't the best optical equipment, but it was all I had, and I watched. So this is what she sees, I guess. She says, Merlin pressed his advantage and hopped as a flea and was almost upon the creature's very back, about a meter behind. He could have touched the imp. He could have touched the imp had he reached out. He dropped his blaster, it appeared, and then he stopped. Merlin grabbed one of these dry, hollow, tree-like weeds, which broke, and they both tumbled downhill. The imp leaped again into the air, and at about the apex, he exited the bubble's edge and disintegrated. The alien creature ceased to exist. Merlin let go of the weed and, as I swung the spyglass to observe, was looking uphill, certainly aware the imp had been destroyed. Some of its gear fell, though, outside the edge, which didn't matter, and Merlin ignored it, too. Merlin stood, slid, got his footing, and found a path down. He returned to his wreckage. Later I found his blaster, which was a goddamn flash gun. He didn't miss the imp. He bluffed. He fired nothing but visible light, the sneaky old bastard. But, you know, even I was fooled. Let's see. I watched on the tracker viewer stone from the future agent as Merlin paused briefly at the Endeavor and then hopped back to West Covina, where he was, I'm sure, about to unearth a large cache of dirks and halberds and torture device-looking machines. And that, my friends, is the end of part 4 and the end of chapter 7 of Macmillan the Magician. Wow, that was alright. It wasn't even as long as I thought it would be. Alright, so since nobody other than Jennifer and I have anything to read, and I'm pretty amped up because I was very excited to finish chapter 7 and even all the editing. That was one, let's see, I wrote it and then I transcribed it from, so I write it using a pencil, a kind of a cheap pen that I got from Target. So I write it in my notebook with the leather binding. Then I type it up into a Google Doc, and when I do that, I also do some light editing. And then I did some editing after that. That was so long, though, that it took 3.5 hours to edit. Or at least 2 hours to edit. I don't know. I may have taken breaks just to bitch at people on Twitter, risk getting myself suspended some more. Let me see. Yeah, so that was like a third revision or a third version. A second revision? Anyway, I was very amped because I basically was very productive. All right, let's do another preview, kind of pseudo preview, the Key to Everything bonus episode. I've already sent some pages. I took photos of the pages and forwarded them to your friend and mine, Jennifer Morency, and I asked her nicely if she wouldn't do me a favor and read, well, I only really need her to read one, but obviously it would be better for me if she reads more than one. She picked one that, well, you'll see, I hope. Anyway, alright, so here's another Key to Everything poem. So since I read from page 33, I found page 66. This says it's H. Amelia Paredes, P-A-R-E-D-E-S. Says it's from Breath, and it also says poem 3. And gosh, these are all just so short. Redwood Grove, sink ye one spirit and see, rumor of wind between them, throat quivers, hawk keens, restless waves cull your heart. Rivers lull the ocean in your veins. Tides shape my body to your desire. Hold me until my breath becomes a delirium of elements between us. In the distant mist, foghorn sobs. An awful silence follows. Your shoulders soft as cloudbank. Save my mouth from the cut of its screams. In your eyes, twilight resonates. Mysterious hue as day turns and expires. Across forgotten coast, wild grasses turn to the sea. My lips shape your name, echo the turbulence of our bodies. These are so short, I'm going to read the next one. Oh, jeez. All right, so it's also very short. This one's on page 67, and it's from Joan Larkin, and it's called Want. It's actually longer than the one I just read. She wants an old house full of cups and the ghosts of last century's lesbians. I want a spotless apartment, a fast computer. She wants a wood stove, three cords of ash, an axe. I want a clean gas flame. She wants a row of jars, oats, coriander, thick green oil. I want nothing to store. She wants pomanders, linens, baby quilts, scrapbooks. She wants Wellesley reunions. I want gleaming floorboards, the river's reflection. She wants shrimp and sweat and salt. She wants chocolate. I want Reku bowl, steam rising from rice. She wants goats, chickens, children, feeding and weeping. I want wind from the river freshening cleared rooms. She wants birthdays, theaters, flags, peonies. I want words like lasers. I want words like lasers. She wants mother's tenderness, touch ancient as the river. I want a woman's wit swift as a fox. Meanwhile, she's in her city meeting her deadline. I'm in my mill village out late with a dog, listening to the pinging wind bells, thinking of the 12 years of wanting apart and together. Meanwhile, we've kissed all weekend. We want to drive the 100 miles and try it again. Alright, so I'm gonna go and I'm gonna talk to Jill a little and I'm gonna eat up like, oh my god, 16 of those peanut butter and jelly quarters. That's right. I've got my $4 ready. I had it converted to quarters just for the occasion. And I'll be back. You guys, if you want to read, now is the last chance. Alright. Alright, let's go. Okay, I really hope the microphone's working because that was a lot of recording. You guys can hear me, right? Hello? 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 I don't know. I don't know what's going on. If you can't hear me, I don't know how much it matters. I don't seem to have any audience. I'm just talking into the void. I'm talking into Nietzsche's abyss. When you talk into the abyss, it really doesn't matter if the abyss ignores you. Alright, so I have been R. Wesley Edwards, or Rob, or Bob, or Robert. And we also thank you to Jennifer Morency and Jill and her peanut butter and jelly quarters and our halfway decent coffee that she's been flinging, as is her job here at the Cormorant Cafe. I suppose I have to say the mic is closed because it's over now. It's all over now. I guess it's over an hour, but that read really wasn't as long as I thought it would be. If I had just read it straight through, it would have been less than an hour, I think. Alright, good night. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing and thank you for smoking, not smoking. We'll see how, the narrator doesn't smoke, but the agent does. She thinks he's from the future. And he's like, oh, obviously you smoke, so you wanna... Alright, sorry, anyway. Alright, I'll go now. Enjoy your coffee. I don't know. Thanks again. Thanks for listening. Thanks again, Jennifer and Jill. And, I hope you liked listening to Chapter 7 as much as I enjoyed writing it. Good night.
I am reality's whore.
This place is dangerous.